Hello and welcome to NewsHour on the BBC World Service. I'm Celia Hatton, coming to you live from London. We're going to start this edition of the programme with some breaking news that's come to us just in the last half hour. The President of South Korea, Yoon Suk-yeol, has declared martial law. In an unannounced late-night television address, Mr. Yoon said the move was necessary to protect the country from North Korea's communist forces, and he said to eliminate anti-state elements. We're going to be live in Seoul in the next 15 minutes. But first, let's listen to what Mr. Yoon had to say.
친애하는 국민 여러분, 저는 북한 공산 세력의 위협으로부터
He's delivering his late-night television and address. We're going to be going to that information just a little bit later. But for now, let's move on to our other top story. And a sentence we haven't been able to say on this program for almost 8 years. The U.S. president is visiting an African country. Joe Biden is in Angola for a two-day visit. A couple of years ago, he'd said his administration was all in with Africa, and yet this is his first visit to the African continent during his presidency. He's also the first U.S. president to ever visit Angola, a country with deep ties to China and Russia, and now warming ties with Washington. On his arrival, a military band played this Star-Spangled Banner. During talks with his counterpart, João Lourenço, President Biden praised the relationship between the two countries.
I'm proud, very proud, to be the first American president to visit Angola. And I'm deeply proud of everything we have done together to transform our partnership thus far.
He'll also deliver a speech at the Museum of Slavery later today. But the expected high point of Mr. Biden's Angola trip comes tomorrow. He'll visit the seaport in the city of Lobito, the start of an upgraded high-speed railway line that's designed to carry essential minerals from the heart of Africa to eager buyers in Europe and the U.S. The Lobito corridor will connect cobalt, lithium, and copper mines in the Democratic Republic of Congo and the Copper Belt region of Zambia to the port of Lobito on the Atlantic Ocean. The U.S. has committed $3 billion towards the project, which could bring rich rewards, though it's also the subject of fierce criticism. On this edition of NewsHour, we'll look at the promises surrounding the Lobito Corridor Railway and Washington's relationship with African countries and with countries such as China, forging strong relationships across the African continent. We'll ask, is the U.S. investing too little, too late? Joining us now from Lisbon is Paula Cristina Rock, a visiting scholar at the University of Oxford and the author of two books on Angola. Paula, what is this railway project designed to do?
Hi, thank you. So the Lobito Corridor is the first stage of what will become a trans-African railway line that will link the Atlantic to the Indian Oceans. And it's more or less to counter the Chinese project of the Road and Belt Initiative. Now, the project itself is uniquely conditioned to extracting minerals, like you said, that are vital for the green transformation of the West's energy transformation. So all of these critical rare earth minerals that China dominates 50% of the market in is now a catch-up. It's a symbol of the West and in particular the US's race to catch up with China in accessing these critical minerals so it can develop its own capacity in electric vehicles and other industries that it requires.
Do you think this is a deal that's good for Angola?
Well, I think any deal that's happening now, I mean, we're facing a scramble for Africa. Before it was on other natural resources. Now it's on these minerals. And I think it'll perpetuate a level of eco-colonialism that will keep countries indebted and perpetuate cycles of poverty. It won't generate employment, and it won't address development concerns. So these are purely extractive processes and purely extractive transactional deals. But it isn't the only one. The U.S. is also investing a lot of money, almost $1 billion worth in an oil refinery in Soyo. Again, it will create U.S. jobs that will come to create that, to build the infrastructure, but it won't create Angolan jobs. And then there's another element. Because the U.S. has now deemed Angola as a strategic partner and as a defense cooperation partner. In fact, Angola joined the Artemis Accord on space defense. It's the only other, only one of three African countries, the others being Rwanda, Nigeria, and is now a key partner in AFRICOM. It will probably delay the process of democratization because Angola, like it or not, is a repressive state. And so the U.S. coming in will almost whitewash the records of human rights violations and the stealing of elections that have happened for decades. And so this will have a nefarious impact on civil society, on human rights activists, on the press that has been completely neutered in the last few years. And military aid will do in Angola what it has done in Uganda and in Egypt, which is only consolidate the power of the ruling regime towards also supporting U.S. Interests and national security interests in the region and the war on terror. And the U.S. didn't have a an ally in Central and Southern Africa the way that Angola can become one.
Okay, Paula, stay with us. I want to bring in the words of Mark Green. He's a former U.S. ambassador to Tanzania and the head of USAID under President Trump during Mr. Trump's first presidency. Mr. Green is now president and CEO of the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. We asked, what does he think of this rail project?
To me, the most important part about it shows what's possible. It's a down payment on the kind of relationship that I think the U.S. needs to have across the continent, not just in Angola and the immediate area, but all across the continent. We want to foster investment that creates jobs, that does provide benefits to the U.S. and others through securing critical minerals that are so important for the new economy. But it really is about a down payment on an enhanced relationship that is, I think, mutually beneficial.
You've mentioned a down payment. It really feels like you're kind of casting forward to the kind of the relationship that you want the United States to have with countries on the African continent. Is this all happening a little too late? This is Joe Biden's first visit to any African country during the course of his presidency.
Well, look, first off, any time a president goes to the African continent, that's good news. I wish that it were earlier. I wish that it were more sweeping and broader, and I wish it were under better circumstances in terms of politics back here in the U.S. But nonetheless, it's very good news. Also, remember that really what's at the heart of this project are initiatives that were started under the last administration and are carrying forward, and I hope will get enhanced and expanded in the upcoming Trump administration.
We should point out that Mr. Trump did not visit Africa at any point during his last presidency. Do you feel that the future Trump administration will continue with this expansion of a focus on Africa?
Yes, I think that will happen. And that's sort of what we're hearing behind the scenes. I think there's a recognition that we're in a new era. We're in an era of strategic competition, which means that we need to further economic alliances and build partnerships in Africa, the youngest continent in the world in terms of demographics, a continent that I think naturally looks towards the West. It's ripe for an enhanced relationship, so I don't see why the new Trump administration wouldn't try to take it to new heights.
You mentioned strategic competition. Of course, we have to bring in China at this point. China has been working to develop very strong relationships with countries across Africa. In fact, Beijing hosts an African summit, an African leaders summit every single year. Is Washington playing catch up?
Well, no, I don't think so. And the reason why not is there are so many initiatives and programs that have been underway, U.S. programs that have been underway in Africa, such as PEPFAR, the AIDS Initiative, the Peace Corps, President's Malaria Initiative, the Millennium Challenge Corporation. This is a new era, and these are new types of investments and new initiatives. But the U.S. relationship with much of Africa is very strong, it's bipartisan, and it's vibrant. So, no, it isn't too late. But it's also important to remember the difference in what China and other authoritarian powers offer and what the U.S. and Europe and the West offer. The U.S., Europe, and the West, our goal is to enhance self-reliance with all of our partners. We want countries to go from being aid recipients to partners to, in a perfect world, fellow donors. We want them to be self-reliant. Most of the authoritarian investments do the opposite. They enhance dependency. It's a very stark contrast. So yes, I think the U.S. moves more slowly and Europe does as well. On the other hand, what it is that we offer is really what young Africans want, a chance to guide their own future.
And yet what many people in Africa say is that Beijing has offered loans and deals that don't have strings, that aren't tied to various developmental goals. They offer engineering advice and structural advice, and that's the kind of thing that they need in order to get these big infrastructure projects moving. The United States doesn't seem to be offering much along those lines. Will that change, do you think, moving forward?
First off, the fine print in the deals coming from Beijing are often damaging. The lines on resources, the lines on land, and the debt escalation that comes with Chinese financing. That's certainly, I think, part of the equation. But more significantly, I think what you'll see under President Trump is an effort to move much more quickly.
That was Mark A. Green, president and CEO of the Wilson Center. Let's go back to the Angola analyst, Paula Cristina Roque in Lisbon. Paula, you've just heard the comments from Ambassador Green. Do you share the same optimism about the incoming Trump administration and its relationship with African countries?
Well, I think he's correct when it comes to America defends interests, not principles. And President Trump will do exactly the same. It's a realpolitik perspective that they're looking at on the African continent. But they're also doing so to counter, like you said, Chinese trade. I mean, Angola is China's largest African trade partner. So I think this will be interesting for President Trump. But also it's supposed to temper any expansion, economic expansion of Russia. So it's almost like Angola, that suffered tremendously under the Cold War, is now facing a renewed interest of global and geopolitical rivalries, and a new Cold War is emerging, which won't benefit
Paula.
Much of the Angolan people.
Paula Cristina Roque, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much, Paula Cristina Roque, visiting scholar at the University of Oxford, author of two books on Angola. We'll continue to track that visit by Joe Biden to Angola. Please stay with us. Lots more to come on NewsHour. Coming up, Australian actress Kate Blanchett on her new film, Rumours, an absurdist comedy set during a G7 summit.
It's partly a political satire, but then as soon as you think it is, it's a soap opera, it's a monster movie, it's a B-thriller. We always wonder what happens in the corridors of power, and often it's just people saying, can I have a cheese sandwich?
Some other stories we're tracking this hour. The president of South Korea has declared martial law, saying the country needed to be protected from anti-state forces, as he put it, and North Korea. The Taliban government in Afghanistan has banned all medical training for women in the country, raising particular concerns about support during childbirth. And 13 women from the Philippines have been sentenced in Cambodia for illegally acting as surrogate mothers. Stay with us on NewsHour. Let's return to our top story. The president of South Korea has declared martial law, saying the country needed to be protected from North Korea's communist forces. He made the announcement in a late-night television address.
Dear citizens, I hereby declare martial law to protect the Republic of Korea from the threats posed by North Korean communist forces, and to eradicate in one sweep the shameless pro-North anti-state forces that are plundering the freedom and happiness of our people, and to safeguard the constitutional order of freedom.
President of South Korea, Yoon Sung-yeol, there. Well, John Nilsson Wright is an associate professor in modern Japanese studies at the University of Cambridge. He's on the line from Seoul with us. John, tell us more about what the president said.
Well, I mean, I have to tell you that I have literally just woken up here. I've been attending a conference at which we just saw the former foreign minister of Park Jin giving a presentation. It looked like everything was normal. And I'm currently on the street in the center of Seoul in Gwanghwamun, which is just a stone's throw from where the presidential office used to be, the so-called Blue House. And I'm trying to get a sense of what's going on. Nobody here seems to know. I've just been chatting to a policeman who's as mystified as I am at what may be going on.
John,
in terms
this is
of what you just.
This is all happening as Mr. Yoon is facing calls for impeachment.
Yes. So, I mean, the National Assembly is controlled by the main opposition party, Democratic Party. There have been moves to impeach both the president, or at least certainly members of his administration, prosecutors. It looked like this was simply politics of a normal sort. You know, it's very adversarial. The left versus right contest here has become increasingly bitter, but nobody would have expected a response such as this. And of course, martial law would normally be associated with restrictions on what the public can do. I don't see any sign of that at this stage. As I say, the streets look normal, but people here are certainly bewildered. And we're all trying to figure out what may be going on and what is behind this.
It is surprising, isn't it? Because South Korea has a very advanced economy. It's had a very relatively stable democracy in place for quite some time, but it does have a history of imposing martial law.
Yes, but we're going back now to the 1970s. I mean, the last instance where martial law was declared was in 1980, following the assassination of Park Chung-hee, who was the authoritarian leader of the country for the best part of 2 to 3 decades. Nothing would have prepared the country, I think, and certainly the current generation, for what is happening, what appears to be happening at the moment. But as I say, it is somewhat surreal. I'm standing at the main intersection here, watching people moving around as if nothing has really happened other than them trying to figure out what's going on. The police do not seem to be in evidence. There is certainly no sign of the military on the streets of Seoul. Clearly, something is happening. My own interpretation based on this very limited information is that the president has decided to go after what he calls the enemy within, effectively, internal forces aligned against him. Now, if we think back to just 2 years ago when the president gave a national address on August 15th, the Day of National Liberation, he did use language that suggested a very sort of uncompromising criticism of progressive politicians, using language that in a way evokes what he's just said. But this seemed to be, again, a political ploy rather than something that reflected a genuine sense that the country was at risk. So I'm afraid I don't have a great deal of clarification at the moment. But obviously, okay. I and many other people are watching this very, very closely.
Okay, John, thank you for speaking to us at such short notice. John Nilsson Wright is an associate professor at the University of Cambridge. He was speaking to us from Seoul. The annual meeting of the leaders of the G7 group of industrialized nations, not a phrase to set the pulses racing, unless that is you're talking about the fictional G7 summit in Germany, which forms the backdrop to Rumours, a new comedy by the Canadian filmmaker Guy Maddin. NewsHour's James Kumarasamy has been speaking to the star of that film, Cate Blanchett, and the director. He began with the film's opening shot, the so-called family photo of G7 leaders together.
The G7 manages to come up with family photos every year that are hilarious. They just have such awkward looks on their faces, but they're all united by some alpine backdrop or seaside. It's just odd.
Kate, your character, well, you had a lot of fun with her, didn't you?
Yes, and it just seemed like a fantastic way to approach the systemic failures of the world from a warm-hearted human place.
Well, it is very human and relationships. And your character, of course, is one who has a relationship in the film with the Canadian Prime Minister. It's we're getting under the bonnet, things that we, I guess, sort of imagine or wonder what is happening at those big meetings. Was that an important part of this view, Kate?
Yes, I'd never read anything like it. I think the screenplay, and I think the film does as well, it really sort of deliberately and often perversely, with hilarious results, sort of shifts tone. It's sort of, it's partly a political satire, but then as soon as you think it is, it's a soap opera, it's a monster movie, it's a B thriller. We always wonder what happens in the corridors of power. And often it's just people saying, can I have a cheese sandwich? You know, and I think that that was part of the thing I loved, is that once their assistants and then they hadn't were gone and they didn't have any mobile phone service, they didn't know who they were.
This is obviously a very visual movie. It looks amazing. But language is really important, isn't it? I mean, not just this rather bland statement that they spend the whole movie working towards at the end, these sort of political vagaries. But you know, you've got this, I found it hilarious sequence where Alicia Vikander's character comes in and they're trying to work out what language she's speaking. It's obviously sweet. She's a Swedish actress, we know that. But they go through about a dozen different languages.
What is this large brain?
A woman's brain, I would say.
She can only speak gibberish.
Swedish. She's just speaking Swedish.
For you, how where does sort of the language fit into this film?
I think, you know, as you say, a lot of that bureaucratic speak is often designed to offend no one and achieve nothing, you know. And so it can get very frustrating, I think, to eddy around in it. It's very easy to judge these things until you're actually in the situation where you're trying to prevent a nuclear war and make sure that trade can still continue through war zones and across cultures. It's a really complex thing. I think it takes a lot of energy, actually, and a lot of selflessness to lead a country and a nation. And I think what I love about it is that even in the midst of this sort of apocalyptic backdrop, and they're beset upon by sort of these floppy antagonists who are self-pleasuring in the background, they don't know what's going on, they never lose their civility or their kindness to one another.
Well, look, it does rather sort of beg the question. You've taken the G7 as your sort of starting point. There are kind of competing political blocks in the world now. There's a, you know, the BRICS, where you've got Russia and China. I mean, would that be a starting point for a sequel, perhaps, Guy?
It seems like this is endless. Do you remember those continuous towels? You probably don't have them in the UK anymore.
Oh, yes. They're very unhygienic.
Yeah, right. They just recycle the same stuff. It's sort of a Mobius strip of linen teeming with germs. It seems to me like G7 summits are like one big continuous towel.
Kate Blanchett and director Guy Maddin speaking to my colleague James Kamarasamy. Welcome back to NewsHour. Well, think of France and you might imagine a glass of fine wine. It's part of the French way of life, or at least it has been. There's a talk of a crisis in the wine industry because of the climate and changing tastes. John Murphy has been to the heart of the French winemaking region to find out what's going on.
The smell, the vine has a special smell when you cut it, and it felt like blood to me, you know.
Marie-Caroline Rosier is standing in a newly ploughed field. Her vines have been pulled up this year. Confronted by unpredictable and destructive weather, she and her sister felt they had little choice.
In 2017, we lost 80% with the frost, and in 2022, we lost everything. A storm of hail just ruined everything.
How big were these hailstones?
They were like that, maybe a golf ball.
From an original 19 hectares here in the Bordeaux region, the family now has just three left, with no intention of planting new vines.
It's extreme. The climate, when it rains too much. When the wind blows, it blows so strongly that it breaks everything.
Sébastien d'Anjou steers his battered 4x4 around his family's vineyards in the foothills of the Pyrenees Mountains in southwest France.
It stopped raining 3 years ago. It's the most important problem we have ever had. Look at the soils. They are dry. Everything is dry.
While the Bordeaux region has suffered from too much rain, as well as frosts, hailstorms and disease, particularly the fungus mildew, Sébastien's corner of France in Languedoc-Roussillon has been parched.
There are some vines which died, so we replace every year.
In fact, here we can see in this field there are lots of ancient-looking vines, but next to them, dotted around. There are these baby little vines.
Yeah. They will adapt themselves if they have time to adapt. The problem is that it's so brutal, the rapidity of this change, that we won't have time to adapt. That's our fear.
What about your particular harvest this year?
A very good quality, but there's not enough. It's 50%.
In some other wine regions, like the Jura, its estimated production is down 70% this year. On top of that, tastes are changing. People are drinking less. Though wine remains the single biggest source of jobs in many rural areas and earns billions in export and tax revenue for the country. But facing a litany of challenges, some winemakers have decided, ça suffit, that's enough.
It wasn't hard for me, it was hard for my mum.
For Marie-Caroline Rosier, there's no way back. Her sister's found a job elsewhere, and she's now trying to keep the family's 15th century chateau going by offering bed and breakfast and hiring it out for functions like weddings. It marks the end of a century of winemaking here.
That report from John Murphy, and you can hear more about on that story on assignment coming up on the World Service. This is NewsHour. I'm Celia Hatton coming to you live from London. Let's go back to our top story in breaking news. In the last half hour, the president of South Korea, Yoon Suk-yeol, has declared martial law. In an unannounced late-night television address, Mr. Yoon said the move was necessary to protect the country, he said, from North Korea's communist forces and to eliminate anti-state elements. Well, for more on this, I'm joined by my colleague, Asia-Pacific regional editor Mickey Bristow. Mickey, how much of a surprise was this? Did anyone expect this to come?
Well, I certainly think it's a surprise, and it seems that in South Korea it's taken people by surprise too, from the reaction that has already come in. As you indicated there, Yoon Suk-yeol announced on TV late night in South Korea that he was declaring martial law. Ostensibly, he named North Korean forces, communist forces in North Korea, as the reason for doing this. But then in this speech, he went on essentially to identify the opposition, what he called anti-state forces, shameless pro-North Korean forces, which he appeared to suggest were inside South Korea. So he took a pot shot, really, at the opposition, saying that parliaments have become a haven for criminals, a den of legislative dictatorship trying to paralyse the country. So although the president started off by identifying North Korea, he didn't go on to say what those North Korean threats were. He did say a lot more about the opposition forces in South Korea itself, who have over recent months been trying to stymie his political agenda.
Yeah, tell me more about what he's facing domestically.
Well, domestically, Yoon Suk-yeol is enormously unpopular. His popularity has dropped terribly over this year. Earlier on this year, there were legislative elections. His party, the People Power Party, lost ground to the Democratic Party. And what's happened is that the Democratic Party is holding up a lot of legislation in Parliament, most notably recently the budget, trying to cut the amount of money that the president can spend on all kinds of things. In fact, he mentioned that in his speech as justification for declaring martial law. There have also been other things as well. The opposition have been targeting the president's wife, trying to launch a prosecution against her, even suggesting they might impeach the president himself. So it's really his main problems have been with the opposition forces within South Korea.
I mean, South Korea, a liberal democracy, a very advanced economy, now suddenly placed under martial law. What a change.
Yeah, the tone of your voice there sounds as though you're surprised. I think everybody's taken by surprise. If this had been North Korea, a dictatorship under Kim Jong-un, then nobody would be surprised. In fact, the country is run as a martial law, under martial law terms, or similar terms at the moment. But in South Korea, a liberal democracy, they've had many, many transfers of power over the last few decades, presidents, new legislative assemblies. lots of changes. It seems incredible that it could happen in South Korea.
Okay, Mickey, I'll let you go. I know you need to track this developing story. That was Mickey Bristow, our Asia Pacific editor. Fierce fighting is continuing in Syria. Rebel forces have cemented their hold on the country's second largest city, Aleppo. They're now encountering resistance in their bid to capture the smaller city of Hama to the south. Hama, a city of 1 million, would be a crucial gain. The main rebel group, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS, is working in coordination with another rebel faction, a Turkey-backed group, the Syrian National Army. Well, the leader of HTS is Abu Muhammad al-Julani. He's been the de facto leader of the Syrian province of Idlib over the last few years, and he appears to have big ambitions, stating that he aims to conquer not just Aleppo and Hama, but Damascus too. So who is Abu Muhammad al-Julani? Martin Smith is a documentary maker who is probably the only Western journalist who's interviewed the HTS leader. He joins us now. Martin, what was it like to interview Julani?
It was an interesting experience, for sure. We arrived there in 2021 to talk to him at a time when he was very much trying to polish his image to the West. It wasn't our intent to help him do that. It was simply an opportunity to understand who he was, where he came from, what his ambitions were. And what we found was that he had eschewed his connections with Al-Qaeda, with ISIS, and he was trying very hard to turn his attention, as he had been for several years before I met him, against Assad. And he had this ambition to march all the way to Damascus. I thought it was a bit of a pipe dream, but now we see he's taken the opportunity to seize Aleppo, and he's fighting to the south against to seize Hama.
Al-Julani had very strong links with Al-Qaeda. He was a part of Al-Qaeda. He has said that he's made a break with that group. Do you believe that?
I do. I mean, in fact, when I was there, he was arresting or engaged in battles against Al-Qaeda and against ISIS. Yes, it's part of his CV. He spent 5 years in U.S. custody in Buka when he was arrested while he was fighting with Al-Qaeda in Iraq. He got out of there and he was determined to return to Syria. He went to Baghdadi, the head of ISIS, and he asked for money and a few men to go into Syria and set up a branch of Al-Qaeda at that time. And he then pursued a strategy of trying to win over, get popular support. And in doing that, he eventually broke with Baghdadi and he broke with Al-Qaeda.
Mm, but is he a moderate or where does he stand now?
I wouldn't call him a moderate. He believes in Sharia law. Women have very few rights. He doesn't allow freedom of speech or dissent. But on the other hand, those people that were reporters inside Syria when he was fighting against Assad in the south said that he was much less brutal, much less willing to go after civilian targets. Al-Qaeda and ISIS ruled from terror, and they were fine with moving suicide bombers into marketplaces just to strike fear in people. That was not what Julani was trying to do. So he struck, for the most part, non-civilian targets, military targets. It's not to say he's a moderate. His prisons are full of people who have given credible accounts of his brutality, his torture.
Okay, Martin, we'll leave it there. Martin Smith, a documentary maker who has interviewed Muhammad al-Julani. Well, many would argue that al-Julani's control of large parts of Idlib province and now his ability to take over Syria's second city, Aleppo, would not have been possible without the backing of Turkey. But throughout the Syrian conflict, Turkish roles have not always been transparent or black and white, especially its relationship with the various rebel groups that are fighting President Assad. İlnur Çevik is a member of President Erdogan's Security and Foreign Policy Board. He's in Ankara. We asked, is Turkey worried by the rebel gains across the border?
The offensive does not pose any threat to Turkey. On the contrary, it may help Turkey's causes in the region. For instance, Aleppo is a very key city. The fact that most of the refugees that came to Turkey once upon a time came from Aleppo. Now that Aleppo has been liberated in a way, there is a potential of these people going back to their homes in Aleppo. It would help if some kind of stability was achieved in the area and that these people go back to their homes.
Do you believe it's safe enough for them to do so?
No, not at the moment, of course. I mean, I'm talking about sometime in the future. Once the area is secured, once everything goes back to normal, then, of course, they can go back. But, I mean, there is now a potential that these people can go back because these people under Assad are butchered in the area. Now that Assad is not there, it will help these people.
So Turkey stands to benefit as well from this offensive. As you've said, a number of experts have said that HTS, the main rebel group, would not have launched this campaign without a green light from Turkey. Did Turkey back this offensive?
Yes, it's true that they have launched this thing. But I think Turkey does not have a direct finger on HTS. On the contrary, there are some outside forces like maybe the Americans and Israel that are encouraging HTS to do this.
HTS is leading this rebel offensive, but another rebel group, the Syrian National Army, the SNA, has received backing from Turkey in the past, from the Turkish armed forces before, certainly.
Of course, yes.
But since the SNA is also part of this offensive against Damascus, doesn't that mean then that Turkey is directly involved in this too?
Turkey is, yes, indirectly involved in it because, as you said, the Free Syrian Army, which has now become the Syrian National Army, they're a part of the opposition groups. I mean, there's a big opposition alliance that opposes Assad, and the Syrian National Army is a part of that. The fact that Turkey controls certain pockets in northern Syria is with the help of the Syrian National Army.
Isn't Turkey playing a dangerous game here, though? HTS, the group that's leading the rebel offensive, is a jihadist group. The HTS leader, Abu Muhammad al-Jalani, is a former al-Qaeda leader. There's still a $10 million reward for information leading to his capture. Shouldn't Turkey be worried about HTS gathering territory inside Syria?
Well, you see, that is why I'm saying Turkey is not behind this. It never was, but
But you are indirectly supporting another group that's behind it. So don't you have indirectly a hand in all of this?
Well, you have an indirect hand. Everybody has an indirect hand in everything.
But at what point does Turkey have to take responsibility for what's happening just on the other side of its border?
Well, at this point, the dust has to settle down. What will the reaction of the Russians be? What is happening with the Iranians? You know, we don't control the area. We don't control HTS. So Air Turkey is in the sidelines watching what's going on because Turkey's main concern is the PKK. And the other concern is we don't want a flow of a new exodus of huge refugee influx in Turkey. So Turkey is more concerned with those than if Aleppo is retaken or Aleppo goes down the drain.
İlnur Çevik is a member of the Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's Security and Foreign Policy Board. I'm Celia Hatton, and this is NewsHour on the BBC World Service. Now, let me take you to France and the story of a British spy, codenamed Madeleine, who was in real life an Indian princess. Her real name was Noor Inayat Khan, and she became the first female wireless operator to be sent from Britain into occupied France during the Second World War. She knew the job was so dangerous that the life expectancy for a wireless operator doing this job was estimated to be months, but Inayat still went. However, she was betrayed and captured and then executed at Dachau concentration camp in 1944. She was just 30 years old. On Monday evening, the British Royal Air Force honoured her contribution by displaying the George Cross, Britain's highest civilian honour, which she received posthumously. She's one of only three women to have ever received this honour. Her first cousin, Sheikh Mahmoud Khan, is the only surviving relative who'd met her. He was at the event last night, and he came into the NewsHour studio and told me more about her life from India to France and Britain.
She was the daughter of an elder brother of my father, and so she was a good year older than me. From the moment that her father left to India where he died, she was still quite young, about 14, 15 years old. But she had three siblings who were younger than her. Academically, she wanted to study child psychology. And artistically, she started writing stories, so to speak, for children, but a very profound background which only adults would understand.
Moving to her time, her role,
yes,
in the war.
Yes.
She was royalty. She didn't have to put her life in danger. What drove her to do that?
Yes, that's a very good question indeed. You could say conscience. And you know, she and the next sibling was a boy who differed little in age with her. And the remarkable thing is their father, Hazrat Inayat Khan, who was an Indian Sufi philosopher and mystic, etc., he was a very charismatic person. And what happens very rarely, that same kind of charismatic force was inherited by these two elder children. So when the Germans threatened France, that boy told her, what has to be our attitude? How can we do something in this terrible condition? We have to stand for them. We cannot just be passive. And so then they say, all right, then we go to Britain and we, in one way or another, we share in this war effort.
Now that you know the full story,
yes,
what does this honour mean to you?
Well, you know, from a purely personal point of view, a person you know so well, who had such warmth, who such affection, such cordial kind of relationship with one. And, of course, it was devastating. Suddenly you hear that she went through this terrible torture, this terrible way of the Nazis dealing with their captives. Then, of course, on the other hand, we started to, as you do in the course of the kind of rationalize, is there some kind of line of all that sacrifice? Is there some kind of philosophical, contemplative way of trying to come to grips with that? You know, you have that, what we call Indian Sufism. This term in the Sufi, they call fana, that means passing by. Mm. Passing by the consciousness of one's physical being and see what that essence of the inner being, that inner reality, can be discovered.
That was Sheikh Mahmoud Khan speaking about the life of his cousin, the Indian princess turned British spy in France, Noor Inayat Khan. Well, let's return to our top story. In the last half hour, the president of South Korea, Yoon Suk-yeol, has declared martial law. In a surprise and unannounced late-night television address, Mr. Yoon said the move was necessary to protect the country from North Korea's communist forces and to eliminate anti-state elements. And just recently, we've heard that the South Korean National Assembly has been sealed after martial law has been declared. Well, let's speak to Aidan Foster Carter, a Korea expert at Leeds University here in England. Aidan, what have you been hearing? It's a bit of a shock that was part of a late night announcement in South Korea.
It's an absolutely terrible shock, yes. I'm sorry, I need to get out of the way of another call. I could not have imagined anything like this happening at all. It's completely out of the blue. I have to say it's also completely unjustified as far as I can see. South Korea has been for more than 30 years a robust democracy, hard fought sometimes, but a democracy. Of course, for 30 years before that, it was ruled by military dictators. And this was how it started then. So while the facts are still very unclear, and I'm trying to clutch a straw. I, among the little things I've been reading, trying to piece it together, is that the leader of the ruling Conservative Party, the president's own party, is against this move. So we'll see. Basically,
so are you getting the sense that Yoon has really struck out on his own here?
I'm hoping he struck out on his own. The thing is, the man had no, had no political career, and to be honest, no political sense. I mean, he was a prosecutor all his life. I had registered, as many people had, that he'd started talking about the opposition, the Democratic opposition, who, of course, are left-wing and he's right-wing, as being anti-state forces. And I thought this is just the usual rhetoric. I mean, the left-wing always accused the Conservatives of being would-be dictators in disguise. It sounds like Yoon is trying to prove them right. But I thought this was just rhetoric, the idea that he would actually go and do this. And of all things, I mean, I'm sure someone said before, you destroy democracy in order to save it. You know, he says he's trying to save liberal democracy. I've just read the martial law proclamation. You close democracy down. If there were a clear and present danger of any kind, but there is none that I'm aware of. There is none domestically. There is none from North Korea.
This yeah, Aidan, just
unjustified.
We have a very brief time left in the program, but just give us a sense of the fighting between Yoon's party and the opposition that's been going on.
Yeah, well, it has been absolute horrible because the opposition control the assembly. They've got a huge majority, which they increased at the last election. Tells you how popular Yoon is, you know, no mandate of any sort. And they have been being irresponsible. Both sides have been. They've been blocking the budget. And so Yoon has been taken to vetoing bills. So there is a bit of an impasse, but it's something that needs sorting out by dialogue, not by the barrel of a gun.
And what have you been hearing about what's been going on in Seoul?
I'm no use in Exeter. I'm no use on that at all, as far as I can see. Chaotic scenes at the National Assembly, and that the Parliament has been sealed by the military, so the duly elected members can't get in. But that's all I know. I would be dishonest if I pretended I had any special insight on that. I'm, like all of us, I'm hoping to hear more and hoping that it's not as bad as I think it is.
All right. Well, we will continue to track this story as it develops. Thank you very much, Aidan. Aidan Foster Carter, a Korea expert at Leeds University. That's all for this edition of NewsHour. As I said, we're going to continue tracking this story in South Korea and any developments that come. I'm Celia Hatton. From me and the rest of the team here at NewsHour, thank you for listening.